You're listening to the FQXI podcast today.
And that's just amazing and a little insane in the sense of, what does that even mean?
Our countdown of the physics highlights of 2021 continues.
Now, this is a deeply fundamental thing that has often bugged the heck out of me.
With quantum physicist Ian Durham.
From a data analysis standpoint, that is just tremendously impressive.
I'm Zia Morali. Hello again, and welcome to the second part of the rundown of the best advances in physics, at least according to the Foundational Questions Institute, and to Ian Durham in particular. Ian is an FQXI member and a quantum physicist at St. Anselm College in New Hampshire, as I'm sure you all know by now. And we're picking up where we left off in the last edition. Before we get to the top five, there is one more physics highlight that just missed out on making this year's list. Honestly, Ian, this was a surprise to me. I'm not sure you can get much more foundational physics-y than this one. How on earth did it miss out?
I so wanted to make it the top five. I hemmed and hawed about this, but part of what motivates me choosing the top five is, as I also like to spread the wealth around a little bit, and I felt, you know, I'm a quantum physicist, and I felt, well, if everything is quantum on the list, maybe people will get mad at me. So this is a group out of South Korea and Texas A&M and Stevens Institute of Technology that quantified wave-particle duality. And that's just amazing and a little insane in the sense of, what does that even mean? They teach you in basic intro chemistry that particles can be both waves and particles, right? There's a particle nature and a wave nature. They'll tell you, maybe they don't tell you this in the chemistry, but in physics, they should tell you that you can't measure, typically, the wave nature and the particle nature in the same experiment. And in fact, the wave nature, often people will say, well, you can't measure the wave nature in a single experiment. It's really a statistical thing, blah, 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 blah.
And the classic example, apologies to our listeners who have heard this 1,000 times already, is the double slit experiment. So you shine a light at a barrier with two thin vertical slits cut out, and you set up a screen beyond the barrier, and you see an interference pattern build up on the screen. That's the signature behavior of a wave. You then turn down the intensity of the light beam so that it's firing one single photon at a time, and you still gradually get an interference pattern building up on the screen, waviness again. But if you put a detector near one of the slits to see which slit each photon goes through, that is to check which path each photon takes, then you actually destroy the wavy behavior. You no longer get an interference pattern, and instead the photons act like little particles, either going through the left slit or the right slit, and on the screen, instead of the interference pattern, you just get two thick stripes of light lining up with the slits. Lesson over. Anyway, that's the standard example of how when you try and get a sneaky look at both the wave and particle nature of light, you can't. You get either one or you get the other. So how did these folk get around that then, Ian?
Basically, what they did is they had pairs of photons. One is called a signal, one's called an idler. And in this case, it's emitted by a pair of crystals of lithium niobate. So I have a quantum optics lab, and we have crystals that we use to create our signal and idler pair. Basically, they're usually entangled photons. The basic idea is that you have a pump laser, and the pump laser goes through the crystal, and it stimulates every so often. One of the atoms in the crystal will emit a pair of photons. And one is called the signal, and one is called the idler. And in this case, they had two crystals, and by independently altering the chances that each crystal would emit the photons, they showed that the source purity is related to what's called the visibility of the interference fringes, and then the path distinguishability. So the interference fringes are the wave-like property, and the path distinguishability is a particle-like property. So let me actually go back for a second and just quickly explain that. I can do this really simply in terms of the double slit experiment. And in fact, I'll just make a quick push for a paper recently written by Rob Speckens and Matt Liefer and a couple of other guys, David Schmid and Lorenzo Catani, where they talk about why interference phenomenon really isn't that interesting from a quantum standpoint. But so if Rob and Matt will forgive my use of this for the second, if you shine a laser through a double slit, you get an interference pattern. But then the question is if you then say, well, okay, which slit did any individual photon go through? Asking that question is effectively asking, what path did the photon take to get to the screen? You could put a little detector, a tiny little detector, at one of the slits. But as soon as you do that, the interference pattern goes away. So the idea of trying to find the path, which would affirm its particleness, is typically known to destroy the wave nature. The idea is that you can only measure one or the other. And what these guys did is they had these two crystals. They're very thin and they're sandwiched together. Each of the crystals could emit photons. And either one could be the source. You can't know for sure exactly which crystal any one photon came from. It leaves something open about that, or it should. And so these guys were able to independently alter the chances that each crystal would emit photons. And you can do this by rotating the crystal in the housing. They were able to then show that the so-called source purity, the purity of the crystal itself, is related to the visibility interference fringes and the path distinguishability by this sort of simple mathematical expression that two of these guys came up with in 2020. This is really interesting. This is complementarity. This is the Niels Bohr thing all over again.
So here I need to interject, as I am editing and cutting this podcast edition together, that our recording suffered something of a major glitch, caused, I kid you not, by the fact that someone in Ian's house turned on the microwave. Well, that's physics in action for you, I guess. Anyway, there will be a portion now where, unfortunately, the sound quality is a little ropey. Please bear with us and be patient. It will eventually recover. Yeah, the joys of working from home, eh? Back to the interview. So there's a lot there.
Oh, God, yeah.
I shouldn't be pushing you on it because it's not on the list, and yet I'm going to push you on it because it's just fascinating. So just to recap, you set up the double slit experiment for us. And now in this experiment, you've got two crystals. Is it fair to say that they are acting sort of like those slits in the double slit experiment? And what each of these crystals are doing is that they are each producing two photons, one being the signal photon and the other being the idler photon. And what you can kind of do is you can kind of use the signal photons to get some kind of interference pattern, so to get some kind of handle on the waviness. And you use the idler photons to give you some kind of handle on the path taken by the light. So the sort of the particular nature of light. So that's how you're getting a sort of a sense of both of these aspects at the same time.
Yeah, kind of. Yeah. So in particular, what's taking the place of the double slit is specifically the configuration of the lasers with beam splitters. And the interference is created by the fact that you split the beam and then you recombine it. Then to measure the path, which is the particle nature, they use an entanglement measure. And what they've basically done is they've tied these two things, the particle and the wave nature, back to the purity of the original crystal.
You know, okay, when you're talking about source purity, you're really talking about what, just the makeup of the crystal? And I guess, why does that have this effect?
So if you buy a diamond, you shouldn't buy diamonds because diamonds are bad for, the environment and all that kind of other stuff. But anyway, you often look at the purity of it, right? So typically, diamond is pure carbon. But no diamond is pure carbon. You have these impurities that come into the crystal, which are just other atoms that pop up. That's, by the way you can tell a synthetic diamond from a real diamond. Synthetic diamonds have no impurities, right? It's pure carbon. That's essentially what we're talking about in the crystal state. So the purity would be in the crystal itself. That's what they're doing. They have these two crystals that they can basically toggle between, and that allows them to sort of quantify this in a way, adjust these parameters very specifically, and then they can see changes in the particle or the wave nature as they make fine adjustments to these crystals.
Sneaky. It's like a cunning experiment. I like it. And so do my neighbors, apparently, because they've started firing fireworks in the background. But it's appropriate, I think, for coming to the end of the honorable mentions and starting on the list proper.
To the list. Okay. Number five is the results regarding the muon. A muon is like a heavy electron, and they're produced naturally in nature. So when the solar wind collides with the upper atmosphere, it will produce muons. So there are muons cascading down around us all the time. They're used, in fact, to test time dilation all the time, but they're weird. Muons are very, very strange. These particles have magnetic moment. Now, this is a deeply fundamental thing that has often bugged the heck out of me. Magnetic moment. So in classical physics, magnetic fields arise. They're basically just electric fields viewed from a moving reference frame. And so people are like, well, the magnets on my fridge aren't moving. Where do they come from? Well, it's because the particles inside the magnet are spinning. And so if you take an electrical charge, like an electron or an atom or something like that, and you spin it, it's moving. Putting aside for a second the fact that spin in quantum mechanics is not quite the same thing. Take a chunk of charge and you just rotate it. Okay, that's spinning charge. You will create a magnetic field. But of course, at the quantum level, particles aren't really spinning balls. They're really points that have this thing called spin, first of all, which does have genuine angular momentum, but is quantized. If you were to pretend that fundamental particles were these little balls and they were actually spinning, right? You would say, okay, well, then they're electrically charged, so you're going to get a magnetic field out of them. At least it makes a little bit of sense. You know, the quantum part is weird. Why is it quantized? Why? I don't know. So we quantify that through something called the magnetic moment. But here's the weird thing. Neutrinos have magnetic moments, but neutrinos don't have any electrical charge. As far as we know, neutrinos are fundamental particles. They are neutral, and yet they have a magnetic moment. That's bizarre. So magnetic moment is a very strange, strange thing. And we quantify magnetic moment through something known as the G factor. So there's this thing called the muon G2 collaboration.
Right, okay. And the muon G-2 collaboration is trying to precisely measure this magnetic moment of the muon to check that it matches the predictions of the Standard Model of Particle Physics. Because they had hints from an earlier experiment some 20-odd years ago at the Brookhaven National Laboratory in the US that there's a mismatch.
It's been a while that they've known or they've thought that the muon, the actual value of its G2, does not match up with what theory predicts. And this latest experiment improves that discrepancy by quite a bit. It's a group both at Brookhaven National Laboratory and Fermilab, both in the US. The difference between theory and experiment, according to their results, is now 4.2 sigma. So sigma is a statistical, it's like standard deviation kind of thing. The standard for a new discovery is 5 sigma, which means the standard model is, actually, let me just back up and say, because of the 5 sigma cutoff requirement, no one will actually say this yet. But what it suggests is that the standard model is not 100% right, that there is something wrong with the standard model. Now, I have long said, of course the standard model is not 100% right, because the standard model predicts that neutrinos have zero mass. And we know neutrinos don't have zero mass. And we know that neutrinos change into different versions of themselves, right? And that there was the whole solar neutrino problem. We only detected a third of what we expected to detect. And then we realized, oh, that's because they morph into different types of neutrinos. That's not explained by the standard model. So we've known a long time that the standard model needs something else. It's just people seem very married to it because it does make tremendously accurate predictions for what it covers. But clearly, it does not make accurate predictions for the G2 value of the muon.
So, you know, this when this result came out, I mean, this seemed like a shoo-in for number one at the time, because this was one of these big results that even made the BBC News front page. So when physics results make the BBC News front page, then they've gone really kind of mainstream. This is not a small experiment. This is a massive experiment. So the experiment involves a 50-foot diameter superconducting magnetic storage ring. And there was, you know, back in 2013, it was transported 3,200 miles by land. And some people who were following such things may remember that, you know, there was a whole thing where we were following where it was on its path as it was going along the way, because it was just such a sort of massive and exciting thing. But just to give people a sense of what's happening in this experiment. So in this experiment, the collaboration, they send a beam of muons into this storage ring, so this gigantic ring, and then they circulate them thousands of times at nearly the speed of light, and then they use detectors lining the ring to try and see how fast the muons are wobbling, and it's that kind of wobble that's telling them whether or not they're meeting the predictions of the standard model. And as you say, they didn't.
You're talking about the wobble. You know, if it were a classical system and you send a spinning ball into it, and then you were to shift the external magnetic field that's acting, the ball wouldn't necessarily realign itself to the new direction. It would start to precess. It would start to wobble, right? I don't want to suggest that this is anything classical going on here. It's definitely not classical, but it's analogous in the sense that in addition to the spin, you're getting some sort of precession that's going on. And that's the wobble that they're looking at.
We've got this result. And as you say, it, in some sense, it's surprising, but in another sense, you know, people were sort of expecting this. They were looking forward to this. This sort of happens a lot. We've discussed this on the podcast before on previous editions, where there'll be a hint of something at the LHC that suggests that the standard model is wrong. They're never quite there. They're never quite at five sigma. But, you know, there's this sense amongst physicists, you know, in all sorts of fields, let alone particle physics, that they're just waiting for something definitive that says, you know, yeah, now this is the direction we have to go in with the standard model, because we know that the standard model is wrong. My question may be unfair, but given that we're waiting for something to go wrong with the standard model, do we have clues from this about what's happening and which direction to go in, or not yet? Are we waiting for something else?
Going into the extensions of the standard model is a little bit like trying to get our handle on interpretations of quantum mechanics. You know, for every particle physicist out there, there's probably a different extension of the standard model. I would guess that at least once they hit the five sigma threshold, this would rule out some of the extensions that have been proposed over the years. Because what it suggests, by the way, is new physics, right? It suggests physics beyond the standard model. So the question is, well, what is beyond standard model? We need more results to be able to come up with a coherent theory that explains this stuff beyond the standard model, but that still explains what the standard model explains.
So there we are. The standard model is in trouble, but that's not entirely to be sort of unexpected or even to be worried about. In many ways, people might be more worried if they couldn't find evidence that the standard model was wrong, when, as you say, there's been good evidence that it doesn't explain everything for quite a long time. That was that big story that came out back in April, and now it is number 5 on your list.
It is.
I so love the fact, I wanted to mention this earlier, that in trying to explain, you've kind of brought in relativity and upset people about how their fridge magnets work. So thank you for simplifying things.
I teach undergraduates, so, you know.
While we're on the topic of magnetism, number 4.
Number 4. So this was really, really cool. I just love when I can include black hole stuff on here. The Event Horizon Telescope collaboration made an image. It's the first image that shows the polarization of light around a supermassive black hole. Basically, that allows them to map out the magnetic field. It's for M87, which is a supermassive black hole at the heart of M87. It's 6 billion times the mass of the sun. It's just insane, right? These are the same guys who made the first image of a black hole back in 2019, I think it was, which was most certainly on my list. I don't remember where it was on my list, but
I think it was either number 1 or it was joint number 1. It was like a really strong year. But yeah, so it's a beautiful picture. Are we just putting this on the list because it's a really cool picture? Are we putting it on the list because it's just an incredible kind of experimental achievement? Or is this going some way towards teaching us something that we didn't know about black holes and their magnetic fields? Or all of the above?
All of the above. It is. It's just a tremendous achievement. They've already gotten an award from me for actually, you know, taking a picture of a black hole. That was a couple of years ago. But now they have managed to map out the polarization of the light. And from an, I wouldn't say experimental, I'd say from a data analysis standpoint, that is just tremendously impressive. So that's really amazing. But then it does tell us an awful lot about black holes and the magnetic fields around them. Because now we have a feeling for the actual shape of the magnetic field around this black hole. It's curious. It's very interesting. There are extensions to within general relativity that can make predictions about particular things like magnetic fields around very strong objects. So there are certainly theoretical predictions for this, but to be able to actually see it, it's really unusual, and it's just amazing.
Fair enough. So, by the way, as I am looking at the black hole image on New Scientist's website, I'm noticing a headline which is currently trending saying, "Dogs notice when computer animations violate Newton's laws of physics." If only we'd known about that one earlier, that could have made number one, but it's too late now.
Too late now. Oh, well, that they'll have to get an Ig Nobel for that one. Where was it going with this crap? So in Einstein's relativity, when you first get introduced to general relativity, they teach you the Schwarzschild metric. The Schwarzschild metric is a description of the space and time around a black hole, and it's very simple. But it doesn't involve any actual rotation. And, you know, most things in the universe rotate. There are rotating solutions to black holes, you know, things like the Kerr metric. So the Kerr metric is a rotating solution. And what is very clear from the image here is, of course, you can look at it, there's definitely some kind of rotation going on, which, of course, nobody's surprised at because it all just spins. A lot of black holes tend to have been formed from, M87 as a galaxy is spinning. So it's not surprising, but it's interesting that it allows us to see this and look a little bit more clearly at what's going on. One of the interesting things that happens is these black holes gobble stuff up, right? And they pull a material in. And then they actually have, in M87, there are jets. It actually expels material as it's pulling them in. How that happens is governed partly by the magnetic fields. So what this is telling us is it tells us what's happening to a very strongly magnetized gas right at the event horizon. Basically, the magnetic fields, at least in theory, they connect the black holes to that hot plasma that's surrounding them. We don't really know what goes on at the event horizon, right? We don't really know. Right? And nobody's ever seen it. You know, we have that picture from 2 years ago, but it's not a very clear picture of what's going on at the event horizon. So there's sort of this disconnect between what's going on inside the event horizon and what's going on outside the event horizon. And while the gravitational field is useful in telling us a lot about that, it helps to see the important thing about that magnetic field that we see now is that magnetic field originated inside the black hole, right? That's a structure of the black hole itself, right? It indicates that the black hole is charged. It's a charged black hole. We talked about this with the muon rotating, right? Why is there a magnetic field here? Well, it's because the black hole is rotating. It's telling us a little something about the structure inside the black hole in a weird way, right? Because it's telling us that this thing obviously has some kind of a charge to it because it has a magnetic field. So you have this field, you can see what the field is doing out here beyond the event horizon, but you know that it originated inside the event horizon, right? And that is what's really interesting.
That is truly impressive. I feel like you just introduced that discussion of general relativity because you're setting up your own segues now into the next item on the list. And you're inviting me to say, but Ian, general relativity, I mean, that's something we know about on cosmic scales when we talk about black holes. But
this one did not make anyone else's list. And I don't know why nobody thought this was an amazing thing. But
what? Intriguing. To find out what's number three on Ian's list, you will have to tune in to the next episode. Oh, a cliffhanger. You have a clue. It's something to do with general relativity. And if you want another one, maybe go to the podcast page, fqxi.org/community/podcast, and have a listen to some of the recent previous episodes. I've said too much already. For now, congratulations to the scientists for quantifying waviness and particleness, particularity, I don't know, to the Muon G-2 collaboration, and the Event Horizon Telescope team, who are clearly vying with LIGO for the most placings on the FQXI list. You can read more about all of these on the links on the podcast page too. Thanks again to Ian Durham, aka @QuantumMoxie on Twitter, where you'll also find me at FQXI. You can also reach us on Facebook and Instagram, where we are FQXI Physics, and the old-fashioned way by email at podcast@fqxi.org. Till the next episode, I've been Zia Morali. Yeah, I'm off to check my fridge magnet for wobbles.